course, we learned recently that Apple and Tesla had conversations, and perhaps this presages or reflects our earlier discussions about the auto ecosystem colliding with ICT, information and communications technology. Mm-hmm. What's your take on the possibilities here?
Well, a couple of things. One, first of all, I don't get ever excited about hearing about companies talking to each other, because I expect every company talks to every other company pretty much on a regular basis. I'm not surprised if Apple did talk. So if some investigative reporter finds that out, it's not news to me. But, you know, and Elon Musk was asked on Bloomberg about it, and then actually this got posted, and I tweeted just now a quote from him that he, you know, is it true, and he confirmed it. So now he said whether it's on the subject of an acquisition or not, I cannot comment. Which is what you would expect. But then she pressed on, the interviewer pressed on to ask, what would you tell Apple if they were interested in going into the car business? And Elon said he thinks it would be a great idea, which was a nice way of suggesting that he's in the good business.
Right.
but the point is that the question is a very pertinent one. Why would a technology company get into the car business? And to some way, in some way of thinking, actually, they already are. Number one, you know, exhibit one, Google getting into the transportation business, at least from the angle of providing this key driverless technology, which might or might not end up getting them there. But ultimately, they are making a bet that that's a crucial point of pivot or point where the industry would suddenly change the basis of competition, because if you control that aspect of the experience and ownership and everything else, you might actually change the whole business model. And that's indeed their dream and hope. They want to change the way cars are owned, the way cars are driven, the way cars are allocated in society, certain space and certain resources. And if they think that the critical issue is taking the driver out of the picture, then they're probably they've got something to work on there. And then I think that's a valid kind of strategy. At the same time, Apple has Exhibit B. Apple has been promoting its iOS in the car through linking the display of the vehicle to your device. And now, you know, Tesla, of course, has decided to go in an integrated fashion. And the owner of Tesla or founder of Tesla comes from a technology background. So that would be Exhibit C. You have three different approaches to the problem, coming at it from a sort of the industrialist point of view, Elon Musk. Let's make it an accessory to what already exists, which is the Apple model. And the Google model of sort of changing well, it's hard to even put wrap it into a simple package and the bow on it to say what driverless cars could do. It is potentially a very disruptive technology, and it would disrupt the business model of vehicles themselves. So certainly everybody's is sniffing around on the edge of the periphery. But let's be realistic as we try to be in this show. One aspect of the Elon Musk story is that Tesla still is a fairly small player. They are reaching, nearly 30,000 units a year. I think they're aiming for that this year.
Right, they're trying to double, I think, in the next year or two. But, right, it's not very –
it's tiny. It's in that ballpark. Yeah. Now, that is one-tenth of the production line of one plant in a fairly minor brand like the Mini. The Mini plant in Oxford, England, churns out over 300,000 units a year, and that's not necessarily a huge plant. It's a noteworthy plant, but it isn't the biggest in the world, and so you're looking at a long wait to go. Now, of course, if you're patient, that may be worth waiting for. But the overall, the global market is 60 million units. If Elon Musk wants to change that world, he needs to double and double and double and double again. Several. I don't know how long, but it'll take a while. So there are limits to that issue. Now, of course, my take on Tesla is that if they're successful enough, they'll actually be embraced by the market or the industry, and they'll be acquired. That has a problem with it. If the acquirer is actually bankrupt, it's not going to happen, and Tesla may actually sort of reverse acquire itself, kind of like Next did in the case of Apple. So I can imagine, for example, a situation where Tesla would merge with, let's say, Chrysler or Fiat or even a Ford. But they would be actually, although they would be tiny in terms of the volume and value of sales, they might actually take over the company and reestablish.
Well, sure, because they have the Wall Street model. They have the Wall Street props, at least right now.
Right, but it would be. But they also have the intellectual upper hand. They would be bringing the new model. Remember, in resources, processes, and priorities, they would be bringing the new priorities, and they would redefine the merged entity in their terms, in their vision. And sometimes the junior partner brings the new priorities rather than the old entity. And that is indeed where as in the next case came to be, there's a small player becomes really the acquirer. So that's certainly a nexit. That's a possibility. The only way that would not happen would be if the acquirer or the entrant in this case would have a completely asymmetric business model, and then it would not make sense to merge with the larger player. And this is maybe perhaps where Google might be thinking, although I don't know if they've figured out yet what their strategy is from a business model point of view. Well, but it's great. It's exciting to see all of this going on. I would not expect Apple getting involved with Tesla beyond any kind of. If there was a meeting, I would imagine it would be something along the lines of, well, would you be interested in licensing iOS for you know this in-car application? Would you want to do some joint marketing? Would you want to do collaboration on some components? There are lots of things you can talk about besides a merger. And if Apple were to be interested in the auto business, I don't know if they would go through that process. By the way, the other weird thing is that the value of Tesla is not that big. It's a bit over $20 billion. And as we just saw, WhatsApp got bought for nearly as much. So this is not outside of the realm of possibilities that Tesla would be acquired by even a Google or an Apple, because the numbers are not that great, not that huge. They're great in terms of ratios, but it's not a huge number in absolute terms.
Right. So let's step back to Singular and Apple, when some people called Apple's deal with Singular and then AT&T a cashectomy, where essentially Apple had the ability to run, you know, introduce the device and maintain control of their software. So we see Google cutting deals with Audi and a few other car manufacturers to try to provide Android or a version of that in the car. Microsoft did something similar over the years and still has that with Ford and BMW and a few others. Right. So you have that sort of strategy that, let's say, asymmetrical, trying to take over the control of the vehicle or the information part of the vehicle. Mm-hmm. Then you have the acquisition version that you just described. And then you have the completely vertically integrated Google car, self-driving car model. And we had something interesting this last couple of weeks. Ford introduced, speaking of vertical integration, an aluminum truck, which apparently they've locked up supply for a number of years and made a big change in that model. So their most popular truck, which you know, it doesn't get great mileage now. They've shaved, I think, 700 pounds off of it. It's sort of an Apple-type strategy where you buy up the supply chain, right, and you change the manufacturing model. You know, you can think about the MacBook with that metalwork, the aluminum, all those things that they do. And Ford taking a similar strategy to try to change the basis of competition.
Well, aluminum, though, is it really that different? I think that there are a couple of things. Aluminum's been in use by many companies for a long time. I think Jaguar already uses it in their mainstream models. I think, correct me if I'm wrong.
Audi has used it in the past.
Yeah, yep. Audi's up there with aluminum. Mm-hmm. The problem with there are a couple of problems with aluminum, as far as I know, that they are easier. They are harder to repair as bodies, that they have different they're very difficult to do body work with, and so for that reason you need the special tooling and special training to do repairs on them. So that may actually cause the buyer to be spending more in that sense. But but the other thing about aluminum is that it's not a dramatic shift in terms of the production method. The repairs are one thing, but producing aluminum bodies requires more or less the same tooling, as far as I know. The some of the welding may be a little different, but I think spot welding is not going to be that different. I don't see aluminum as being really asymmetric enough for the basis of competition to shift in how cars are manufactured and sold. It's a sustaining improvement, if anything else, that it could be embraced. And I think that's true also, as I said before, for certain types of powertrains, including maybe electric, because we are seeing incumbents embracing that slowly, but they are doing it on their own schedule. So I'm not jumping up and down. What I am curious about is the asymmetry between the electronics in a vehicle and the rest of the mechanicals, right? The mechanical and
right,
and,
right. That body piece driving the strategy and driving the value equation, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And so whether that's a Trojan horse, if you own the operating system
Windows
of the car, yeah, exactly. it's that level. And I think Microsoft again probably did it too early with Sync, which is their mobile operating system, essentially their embedded operating system for cars. And they've been doing it for a long, long time. I think they were at it since 2004, trying to sell automakers on that that principle of let us take care of the software, you guys take care of the hardware. And they've been trying it with BMW, they've been trying it with Ford and even with Fiat. And they were offering various degrees of integration, everything from simply syncing your phone or your device to running the entire OS. And it hasn't paid off for them, and I don't think they've actually... if anything, it's actually cost them a lot of goodwill, because the early systems were very, very, very clumsy and prone to failure. So, in fact, the J.D. Power's ratings on the vehicles with the Sync system are significantly lower than those without it. And so, in fact, the automakers are suffering. Those who went with Microsoft are suffering in terms of customer satisfaction. So it's exactly the worst or the opposite effect that you wanted to get. So it clearly isn't a panacea to simply put the expertise of software from the traditional software companies into cars. I think it needs to be more subtle. And what we have to think about is, again, whether it needs to be modular rather than simply coming from the right supplier. The question of modularity is simply, do you have an open interface so that your device treats the car as an accessory, where the device treats the car as a playback device or as a video output device?
Sure, data source, as we've talked about.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. To this day, most cars, I think, ship only with one open API, which is the auxiliary line-in jack. One exception, though, which is the ODB port. This is what I'm actually going to try out myself. because you have there's an app called Automatic.
Right, right.
With this dongle that you stick into your ODB2 in the U.S., there are three different standards at least in the world. The U.S. is ODB2. Europe has a different one. I think Japan has a different one. But essentially right now, the app and the dongle are working in the U.S. market. And this ODB2 dongle thing you stick on is wirelessly connecting with your device, and you're able to get all the data dumps that device can capture from the control system of the car. And that's a wonderful innovation. I think one that makes a lot of sense. That is essentially an open port, an API that finally allows the device with your own, that you can change over time at the rate of change that is appropriate for the device, meaning you can upgrade every 2 years or whatever. And that device will then suddenly be smart, or you'll be smart because of the device's access to this wealth of information, which, we talked in the past, if you then manage to collect all that data into your into an archive, then you could pass that along to the next owner and say, look, please audit my car. Follow every single thing that's happened to it. And I can guarantee that this has been a well-maintained car, and therefore you should pay more for it. Speaking of which, I did actually buy a new car recently, which put me through this process.
Still with the Daimlers, right?
Sorry?
Still with the Mercedes, right?
Well, not exclusively, but yes, in this case, it's back to the three-pointed star.
Right, right.
So what I did is I this is a back to the old axiom of idle hands find how's it work? Devil's work. The problem was that I was fooling around over the holidays when there wasn't a lot to do, you're hanging out with family, and as everybody sits in the same room together looking at their personal glowing screens, as we all sort of got together to look at our screens together, I was looking at a question about let's go shopping in my mind, that either means shopping for electronics or cars. There's nothing else I can imagine worth buying. So I having, saturated my electronics ownership to a certain level, I thought I'd look at cars again, because I haven't bought one in like 2 years. And so the funny thing that happens, I'm looking on eBay, and I'm looking at initially one type of car, which is a station wagon, which I already own. I was curious what my station wagon was worth. And then I began looking at alternatives. And eventually, as typically happens with hunter-gatherers, you get fixated on the hunt.
On the prize, absolutely.
You get target fixation. Sure. Yeah. And so I began to obsess over pursuing a car I did not need. And so that got me into sort of some assumptions about pricing and bidding and so on. And I ended up actually winning a car auction online. And so let me tell you what the car is. It's a 2004 E500 station wagon, which is E series from Mercedes. And there are a couple of surprises in that.
It's a V8.
It's a V8 engine, which I've never owned before. So it's a massively over-spec'd product for my needs, especially in contrast to the 1.6-liter diesel that I drive in Finland. But one thing is that to my defense, the car in the U.S. would not be driven much. It would be essentially a horse you keep in the barn except to go racing with,
or perhaps a fashion statement, maybe,
or something. Yeah, something of sort of amounting to vanity, like sort of Jay Leno's garage filled with prized possessions that are there mostly for amusement. But the thing was that I also wanted it to be a station wagon, because in case I do drive it, I like to have the family and all kinds of stuff in it. And I've taken several trips with an older version of that car. Actually, that would be my third E-Class wagon. I've owned a 95 in the 2001. And
The 95 was probably the best of the lot, I think.
Oh, yeah. But it's at a point where it needed a lot of care and time, which I didn't have. So that's why I had to go, especially as my wife wouldn't put up with downtime on the vehicle. But anyway, long story. But the point is, I got this car, and I'm really eager to try out this ODB2 system on it. But before I get into that, so the conversation I had with the seller. This is a one owner car, so that worked. So my thought process in buying this thing is. First decision I made as I was going through eBay is like, I'm not going to buy from a dealer. I think dealers provide value, but it also costs more. But if you can find somebody who can offer you the same equal value, which means that they are willing to educate you on the vehicle and that they're willing to quote, stand behind that vehicle to some degree, then I thought a private seller. And in the case of eBay, in fact, the seller was acting on behalf of the owner, who was the seller himself was actually a mechanic. He didn't register the car in his name, but he essentially offered the service of selling it on behalf of an owner. And so there was one owner, but essentially the seller was not the owner. But the thing was that he provided me with all these records about the history of the car, including every invoice from an independent mechanic that had done the service since 2009, and a dump of all the records available from the dealer, which normally are not given to the buyer. So I was able, plus Carfax. So you get the Carfax data, you get the dealer data, you get the independent mechanic data, you get a mechanic who's actually a Mercedes mechanic who has gone over the car from bumper to bumper and analyzed everything about it and tells you what is wrong and not with it. And so going through, and so here's my approach. I actually took the invoices and I typed them all into a spreadsheet, and I track exactly how many service, what the service intervals were, what the mileage was at the given time, how much money was spent. And I'll tell you one thing, the amount of money spent on repairs and service since 2009 is greater than what I paid.
What you paid for the car, of course.
Right.
Classic German used car.
And this is not the full service. This is not the full service record. And in fact, I think the car also had a significant repair done to it in late 2013 when a tree had fallen on it. So although it didn't have an accident like a collision, it actually had some body damage from this particular accident. And that the information about what was replaced in the car because of that damage is part of a dealer record. And that was work done at the dealer because the car was insured. And so I'm looking at all these parts that are brand new in the car, everything from the hood to the radiator, to the condenser, to the fan, to one of the wheels and tires. And all this stuff has changed in the car. And that's all good news to me, because to me, it's not so much that was the car in an accident or not, but rather, did it get fixed well? Am I actually going to be using parts that are probably worth more than the whole car is worth today? And so that's the level of comfort I got, convincing me that this is a decent car. Now, that's the thing that when I was tweeting about this and we spoke about it, this is before the deal closed, but my thought process about the used car process is, or the used car buying process, is that you have this information asymmetry between what even the owner of the car may not know or not track all the details about it, and the buyer wants desperately to know what risk they're taking with the car. And because you don't have the information available to make an informed decision, you tend to discount the vehicle. Now, what I took advantage of is exactly this principle. I had the information, but the market discounted the value of the car. So that, in fact, I paid slightly above market price. But the market price is really atrociously low. I mean, it's about, I would say, between one-fifth and one-sixth of the original purchase price. No, I would say even less.
But isn't that a
one-sixth and one-seventh, something right on that level.
But isn't that a function of, as you described, the eye-watering risk that probably most people aren't comfortable with in terms of the repairs that may loom? You know, a friend of mine has mid-2000s Audi, and it's all road, and a new transmission was required. It was $7,200, and he said, "No thanks."
Right. Well, this is exactly the reason why most people buy new cars.
Right.
Even though you have older cars that are much cheaper. The answer isn't because the car is worse. The answer is because the risk and the on the information content of the vehicle is not visible. There's no way to do assessment of the risk. And that's fundamental to, and I would argue also that I don't think these types of asymmetries exist as much, let's say, in commercial vehicles. I think in the commercial vehicle or the institutionally owned vehicles of the world, that they're assumed to have a certain regime of maintenance. Let's say, you know, let's take an extreme case, like a military or even an aircraft. If you're going to buy an airplane, if you're going to buy, you're a leasing company, and you leasing companies tend to own the planes, whereas the airlines tend to lease them. And so, a leasing company would maybe buy and sell jetliners. And you know, how do they assess the value of a jetliner? Well, there's actually a paper trail as long as you know the wingspan of that plane that explains everything that's ever been done to that airplane. And there's no aircraft that's actually certified to fly unless it's had everything documented and everything taken care of. And so the risk from the buyer's point of view is actually mitigated by the fact that there's information within that vehicle's history that allows you to sort of assess the value of the product going forward in terms of fuel consumption, the remaining airframe lifespan, and remaining engine lifespan. And so your decision process doesn't involve, is it a lemon or not? Your decision process doesn't involve, did the previous owner trash the vehicle or not? It's documented, and it's therefore becomes a moot point as to what happened in the past. You can add and subtract whatever the usage model was, and so it's all there. And that's where we need to go, I would think, and information is going to make it happen. Information systems are going to make it happen, where vehicles are not, huge risks. Rather, they're simply a black box which self-determines its own value.
Let's reflect on that a bit. So that I sent you a link the other day. You know, obviously you practice information asymmetry or information arbitrage with your purchase. There are people who come to the States to buy iPhones and then leave with them, and they practice iPhones as a currency. And there was a couple cases recently where some Americans in the South were buying new BMWs and Mercedes and shipping them to the mainland. And both manufacturers sent prosecutors after these people. It was in the New York Times a couple weeks ago. And I don't know what the basis was.
Sorry, I missed that. From the South to the mainland?
Mainland China, yeah. So they're practicing arbitrage, right, because they can buy a 5 Series or an E-Class in the States, ship it to the mainland, have it sold for twice the price or three times the price. And, of course, Mercedes and BMW don't want this to happen, and yet iPhones go back and forth all the time, or go one direction mostly.
Exactly. And the only reason that they're able to get away with that is because they're smuggleable. Small enough to be essentially mule can be used as. But it's illegal in both cases.
Right. Right. But I guess my point is so here we have the heavy hand of regulation, right? And you have the car manufacturer's interest in maintaining control, and we see this with, you know, their leasing schemes. We see this with their certified pre-owned and all of those things. And so addressing this, I guess the first question is, will the information that provides value to you, will that continue to be available? Will the dealer continue to give you the data on that car? That's,
well,
to me,
again,
one question.
It may be coming out of the hands of the value network today.
Right.
That's the point, is that if you plug this dongle, here's my hypothesis. You plug in this dongle, you then use your iPhone or other device to essentially, you don't have to monitor everything yourself, but you just archive it. You dump it out, and then you store it off in the cloud, and then you, at the end of your ownership life, you offer it to the buyer and saying, if you're willing to the biggest problem that actually will be from the owner's point of view is that how much privacy you lose in the process. But you might be able to essentially offer proof of your good husbandry of the vehicle and therefore demand a higher price. The problem is the market will not give it to you because right now there is no way of pricing it as such. But over the long term, maybe someone can step in and say, let's say a third party can step in and say, Carfax does. We offer this auditing of the archive of data. So maybe the new owner doesn't get to see every single trip you have ever made, where you've gone and all that, but rather they audit it and they flag things which might be like, they'll say exactly how many panic stops have been made. They'll tell you exactly how much gas was consumed, not just how much mileage the car has. They'll tell you exactly how many, tire changes, every single detail about the maintenance of the vehicle, plus the driving of it. So if that happens, then again, it could change the dynamics, and bring up the value of used cars, and thus actually reduce the demand for new cars. Reducing the demand for new cars would imply also, and by the way, it might even incentivize drivers to drive more carefully, more slowly, and all these other good things that would, maintain the value of the car a bit better. Because if you think that you're going to lose 90% of the car's value over 5 years, you're not going to care that much about it, right? And you're expecting depreciation to be astronomical. Now, if somebody were to tell you, I can get you 80% of the value of the car after a couple of years, if you stick this dongle in and drive carefully, then that might change driving behavior. It might change the maintenance behavior. It might change how we treat the planet ultimately, because that's really fundamentally the incentive that causes people to drive or behave certain ways. So anyway, the point is that information is the key to this whole puzzle, and I don't know how the market for this information will develop, but it's suddenly feasible, mainly because we have devices with storage, with connectivity, that can suck the information out without even the consent of the manufacturer, because they've opened these ports up inadvertently. And even if they close them again, you can get some information simply from attaching your own device to the vehicle and bypassing it. But really, I it sounds utopian in a way, but I think this makes a lot of sense, that by democratizing the information of the vehicle, you can create opportunities for entrepreneurs to find ways of closing the asymmetry gap and hence potentially actually changing the economics for the better.
I completely agree. I think the automatic experience, short of some of the data mining issues and data sharing issues, is an opening. And then obviously the asymmetrical entry potentially of Google and maybe Apple and others into the IT space of a car might be interesting too. But so I want to sort of pivot a bit to a different discussion around cars. And, I have an older BMW as well, and it's fun. And their whole brand, has been rear drive, and now they're upsetting the apple cart with a front drive model that's sort of a small minivan. And, of course, the purists are not happy. And, for the last few years, you have written and talked about the interest and need for Apple, for example, to go down market and expand the iPhone line and all that. And we see certainly the German manufacturers just going after every possible niche, from Mercedes with the A-Class, the smart car, up to the S-Class and Maybach, all these
things. I'm concerned that Mercedes is going to run out of letters and BMW is going to run out of numbers.
Right, exactly.
So it's funny because you go to Wikipedia, and the great thing is how they actually, when they talk about a car maker, they'll do a nice diagram at the bottom of the page showing all the model or all the categories of cars. And what you see is like there in the 1950s or 60s, there used to be like three models of Mercedes or three models of BMW.
Exactly.
Two models of Ferrari.
Exactly. And nowadays, 3, 5, 7, yes.
Yeah, you see a dozen. You see this explosion in car not just models, but categories that are they're entering in, right? So, going from having a sedan and a small, medium, and large sedan to suddenly having people carriers or minivans, as they call them, to exotic cars and sports, super sports cars and coupes and coupes or whatever you want to call them. And I've even seen the Mercedes trying to make a two-door S-Class. For example, I mean, these are, it's as if they're like, what could we think of in terms of putting egg, peanut butter and chocolate together?
We've run out of ideas. Let's try to put a different roof on the car or something.
It seems almost desperate in my mind that in the search for growth, the way they're doing it is by saying we can do every possible configuration of body style and potential definition of what is a category. The trouble is, here's I'm going to channel Clay Christensen again, is that the problem, people don't think that I need a type of vehicle. They think I have to do certain things. I have a family. I need a space with a vehicle with more space, or I have a midlife crisis. I need a vehicle with less space. So that's how people think. And so what the car makers try to do is they offer what they call categories. But in fact, the way they're thinking is not that there's an unmet need or job to be done. They say, somebody's introduced a category. They've proven that there's a value in it by selling a certain number. We're going to do the same thing. So you have the Mercedes of the world making minivans and the Ferraris of the world making pickup trucks or what have you. But that is not necessarily a wise thing to do. You have to ask more deeply the question that, does that fit with your brand? Does that fit with your competency? Does that fit? Are you actually detracting value to your core market by expanding and branching out into things which may not fit? And you're getting a marginal. It's like basically it's finance people running the show, and they're saying, well, this makes sense financially. It costs you a little bit more, and you're going to get a little bit more than what you're spending in return. But they're not able to think about either the jobs to be done or the brand impact or some of these other aspects of the whole experience that doing this. So to your point about a front-wheel drive BMW, I think the way they defended it is that, well, most people who buy one series don't realize that it's a rear-wheel drive car. What's the point of
exactly.
buying a rear-wheel drive car?
What, exactly.
You don't understand brand then, do you? Because the whole idea right. isn't that people are aware. So you could say, well, people don't know how many cylinders are in their engine or what drivetrain they have and all that. Well, that's never been the objective, is to have an informed, technically competent audience. The objective is to have something that enthusiasts who are your brand ambassadors, they would be the ones who will say, this is the car to get. This is why also in technology you have these people who are essentially acting as the influencers of opinion. And they are the ones who say, this is the brand that always delivers performance, engineered like no other car in the world, et cetera, et cetera. They're the ones who actually take you to your word and say yes or no, you have accomplished what your brand sets out to do. And they ultimately pass that on to the consumer. So when you say, well, they're a minority, they don't buy that many cars, or their opinion isn't that important, but there will be a price to be paid for diluting your brand. In some way. Now back to Apple, and the question is
right. And what I want to mention here, though, is sort of an interesting thing. One is that you've talked about saturation points in new products. So obviously, the car industry is well past that. And I'm wondering if once smartphones and tablets reach that point, if this is just a natural progression, where, as you say, the finance people take over and they, run their spreadsheets, do their analysis, and, let's create a sort of a half station wagon that we call a GT or, things like that. Is that the evolution we can expect?
Well, that's the trouble, is that you're just simply taking off-the-shelf components and putting them together and say, what if we put chocolate and peanut butter together. That is not going to change snacking.
Right, or plastic around an iPhone, right?
Right. Well, that's true, yeah. But in many cases, the line extensions are valuable creating. What I'm asking is there comes a limit to that, and the question is, when have you crossed over it that the line extension marginally sounds better, but in fact, marginally, it's actually worse because you've done damage to the brand? And the question also is fundamentally, why don't you just stop doing that for a while and think about what other jobs people have to do? One other thing I retweeted, it came from Steve Crandall, actually, via him on Twitter, was that in Germany, more and more young people are rejecting vehicle ownership, and they are doing car sharing through these new model car.
Right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so that's becoming more and more the case. And now, what the automakers are doing is they're actually embracing this and saying, "Okay, we'll actually offer vehicles for these rental fleets that are appropriate and so on." And that's fine. That means that you're starting to think about the job to be done, that people don't value the ownership as much as they do purely the ability to transport these things. And now the key breakthrough is that there's a one-way journey. Now it's possible to do that economically. You're not going to get penalized for picking the car up in one city and dropping it off in another, which is the difference between the sharing and the renting model, the sharing model being something that you don't have the start and end being the same point. But my point is that if you start to think about that, where is that going to lead? Where is the car sharing going to lead in terms of product definition and what the products that you need to develop to enable that behavior? You're not going to be thinking, I think everybody wants to rent an SUV or an SUV/pickup truck with the trailer hitch and, six-wheel drive. They're going to be thinking very carefully around this job of non-ownership and sort of the sharing model and what makes a better car for that. In fact, you might then be looking, I think we talked about this a long time ago, but they might be looking at drivetrains. They might be looking at maintenance issues. They might be looking at plastic body panels that don't deform when bumped or that don't scratch and have, plastic that makes it easier to maintain. So then
sure, Richard Marks modular car or some of these other ones that are
So suddenly you optimize the vehicle for the job to be done, which is like, I don't really want to own a car. I want to just take it from point A to point B, drop it off there. It would need to be smarter than it is today without, it would need to be more self-aware. It would need to offer more information to whoever owns it about maintenance and so on and so on. There's this whole idea of, the car rentals fleets have not imposed any new definition of what a car needs to be since the history. So cars that are rented are average cars.
Well, of course, young people can't rent them anyway, at least in the States. I think you have to be 25 or 26. I don't recall exactly.
Really?
Yes. It's changed since I was 18 or 19. I could do it. But
interesting. That's very interesting. I mean, there's all these risk factors.
Regulations. Yeah.
If somebody were to come around and say, I have an option for young people to drive a vehicle, why is it possible from an insurance point of view? Well, because the ability of the car to not be susceptible to as much damage. It's easier to maintain. It may have, now there's still risk factors with respect to joyriding and so on, but still, maybe the car is so underpowered that you can't really do anything stupid with it. It would just basically just make it up to 25 miles an hour max. And that might work in some context. The thinking again is that the specification of the vehicle that you're seeing now in terms of what can we put together from off-the-shelf configurations would change, or what can we put together given our assembly lines and our capacity to produce, rather than you change it and reorient around, is there a new job to be done for transportation? So the first part of the program, we talked about how technology can come in and change information aspects. But now we can also say, if ownership behavior change, how can you reinvent the vehicle to fit those needs? And there's another third dimension, which is actually, can you attack non-consumption of vehicles in parts of the world where they're still quite rare? And there's another element there about, building modular vehicles and allowing very low low prices and very, very very low production runs to happen. And this is the whole potential disruption of the what I like about the Gordon Murray design, iStream, of making vehicles. And as we had Richard Marks also mentioned, the same concept. So there are those innovators out there who are saying we're going to go after non-consumption or non-consuming contexts. There are those who are going to probably innovate on the basis like, hey, there's new, for existing markets, consumption is changing from ownership to sharing. And then finally, there's this notion of taking on existing car designs by redefining them with technology that is information based. And so all these three are ripe areas, you know, fertile areas for innovation in this market. What isn't ripe, and I think is overdone, is the this notion of just making yet another body shape from a manufacturer that is not used to doing that body shape, suddenly thinking that they're being innovative because they're doing front wheel drive, and that's the crux of it. I think that's just unfortunately. Maybe I'm too critical of the incumbents because they are doing some of these things. They're doing some electric cars. They're looking at sharing. They're doing some electronics. By the way, one more little anecdote. I was in Los Angeles about 2 weeks ago, and we rented a car for one day. We did an air show down there, a private air show. And I there's a great experiment going on there with car renting based on renting out only one type of car, which is an Audi A4. And the company's called Silver Car. And the business model, I think they started in Dallas. They're out in Dallas, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, maybe one or two other places, slowly growing. But the idea is that they're usually not like very close to the other rental places. You've got to take a bus or somebody picks you up or something. It's a little bit more out of in the weeds.
Right. It's a bigger effort. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But from the user's point of view, you get a pretty cool vehicle. It's a modern.
It's an A4, I think, right?
Yep. Yeah, it's an A4. Yep. It's loaded with all kinds of cool technology. One thing they give you, for example, is onboard Wi-Fi through they pay for
right. Verizon's got an LTE deal with Audi. Yeah.
So it's got that really. You show up and boom, you've got bandwidth. You've got very good pricing on gas. I think you pay $5 or something like that, and then you don't have to worry about gas. They've got a very reasonable rate, although it's high. But this is probably lower based on some of the configurations you may have in other players. And I think it was $79, the average rate. We got a special deal because they were running a promotion. But that's the thing. I tried for a day, and I was like, oh, this is not bad. We get to drive a decent car. We get to not worry about a lot of things. It isn't exactly, I think, groundbreaking. I think it's a premium segment of the market that might favor that model. But it's interesting how they are going about trying to redefine the logic of car rental.
Sure, the experience, giving you a different experience, or hopefully a better experience. Although I often rent from Hertz. I guess they have me looped into their different programs. But when you walk in, especially in Phoenix, Los Angeles, or Honolulu, or Miami, they have all the Porsches and Mercedes and the BMWs right in front of you, the Corvettes, and you can pick one of those, of course, but I generally
that's like
not,
500
price range,
probably but, 500 bucks or something like that.
Exactly right. So there is a certain, but I think you're getting to an interesting point, and that's in an earlier Simcar we talked about the death of a salesman. And the Wall Street Journal last night had an article about BMW tossing salesmen for geniuses, and that their current dealerships can no longer handle the product portfolio. So this line extension has now overwhelmed their dealerships. And so you think about these changes, whether it's car sharing or information asymmetry. Well, how would an entrant, how would a new player or an existing player communicate that to the market? Would it be, as you described, with this rental service? Would it be giving you a taste? The the freemium model, you know, is that the way to enter the that sort of market, or what are your thoughts on how do you sell these?
You know, it's a tough call because I said, you know, I was there are a couple experiments that are somewhat contradicting the disruptive orthodoxy, as I would put it, is that we had in the car business, we had let's give three examples of real innovation that's happened. One, I would say, the hybrids. The hybrids, the Prius is a great example of a success story there. It's not necessarily disruptive, but it's actually been a great sustaining story for Toyota, one that actually does seem to be asymmetric because they've managed to leap ahead quite a bit with that technology.
True, distinctive design at the beginning, you know, it was very different looking than other cars.
Yeah, but I think that was an orthodox approach to disruption, meaning that they actually built a car and they launched it at a low price point. They did not make a hybrid from their Lexus line. They made a hybrid from Toyota and actually very cheaply or modestly priced compact car. And so I would say that's orthodox approach to disruption because you're not trying to appeal to the most demanding customers. You're actually trying to appeal to the less demanding customers with a true innovation in terms of lower cost of ownership. The second, though, which is non-orthodox, I think, is Tesla, where Tesla actually did appeal to the high end of the market. And I was in San Francisco or San Jose area, Palo Alto, et cetera, in that peninsula area of the Bay. And I was struck by I had never seen a Tesla before, and I suddenly saw like five in a day.
And, well, it's ground zero. Yes.
Yeah, but it was not only obviously the home of Tesla, but actually the greatest advocates for it are there, and those with tons of money are there, and so they were, you know, if they had $100,000 to spend on a car, they would, you know, would they buy a Porsche or a Tesla? Of course, you're going to get more points with your peers if you buy the Tesla because you know you're suddenly much cooler for having an electric car. But that still, you know, if you're there, you might actually become completely, you might think that Tesla is a huge hit, but still, let's not forget 20,000-30,000 units, right? But Tesla's coming at it this way, and they're being successful. They're getting a lot of attention. They're being profitable even. On an ongoing basis, but not necessarily in a full scope basis. But that's a sort of a break with orthodoxy. And the right. other one, which is actually even more orthodox, but failed, with the Tata Nano, which is a car that presumably would have been disrupted by actually being the lowest priced car in the world, entering into a non-consuming market like India. And actually, hopefully, the idea was that they would disrupt the way cars are consumed in those markets. And that did not work out. So what's going on here in terms of market entry, go-to-market strategies? We have three attempts. One which is, I think, orthodox succeeded. One which is orthodox which failed. And one which is unorthodox and succeeded. So we're not getting a good track record here in terms of what is the...
What's the formula?
What's the formula? You always go in low end. In fact, right. Elon Musk said clearly that no, he's definitely not going to approach it from the low end. He starts at the high end. In fact, even before the Model S, there was the Roadster, which was even more expensive and more exclusive, more unappealing to average buyers. But he started with that. It's basically his model is that the wealthy shall subsidize the less wealthy, and so we're going to use the proceeds and the learnings we get from serving that market, which is price insensitive, to actually cheapen and create lower priced versions. And then the way the auto market also developed, Henry Ford did not establish the market in 1880. He established the market in 1920, and so it took 40 years for the car to go through the luxury phase and the sort of the experimental phase, the handmade and bespoke models and all of that serving really aristocratic people in the late 19th century and early 20th, and then finally became a product for the masses. I think this is where Musk is going with Tesla, is starting with a high-end product and getting it lower priced. Also, I think that was inspired also by the computer market, which also went through the same progression.
Sure, iPhone certainly.
Yeah. And so there's that question about, you know, if you are going to enter into this market with disruptive technology, do you actually begin at the low end as let's say the low end disruption model would work? By the way, you can enter the high end, but that's called a new market disruption. A new market disruption is that the buyer is buying it not because, let's take the iPhone, you're not buying the iPhone because it is a more expensive phone. You're buying it because it's actually a really good, cheap computer that you can put in your pocket. And so at that original price point, you might as well get it because, you know, hey, you're going to pay nearly the same for a phone, and this is a lot better.
Right. It changes the value equation. Right. Exactly.
Right. So, but that's the question, is a car like the Tesla really a completely different vehicle? And is it better on a new dimension of performance? The iPhone was better, absolutely, you know, ages ahead, you know, head and shoulders, whatever superlative you want to use about how much better it was as a phone, but a data-driven device than a Razr as it preceded it. The point I'm making is that the Tesla is not clearly, in my mind, saying that actually this is, yeah, it's a pretty lousy car from the point of view of range. Let's say it has better performance because of the torque, and it's more green, if that's what I define as performance. But I'm not jumping out of my seat and saying I can do things with the Tesla but that I couldn't do before. I could definitely do things with an iPhone that I couldn't do before with any phone. So that's the thing, is unless the Tesla can ride on water, it can go, you know, be submersible, there's nothing it does different and allows me to live a life differently than I did before. In many ways, it actually constrains you more. So that's the thinking, that is it a new market disruption? And if it's not a new market disruption, then it better be a low-end disruption. But that's what I'm saying, is that it's not, if it's neither, and yet it's still successful, then it's actually breaking the sort of the orthodoxy question of disruption. So in fact, what is going on there? And we've argued about this in the past, and I think the point I was making is that, you know, maybe he's just taking advantage of the fact that this industry is so broken and unable to really get out of its own way, that he can just go ahead and do whatever he wants and still be successful because there's very poor competitive response coming from the market. What usually you fear as an entrant is that the incumbents are going to wake up and then essentially eat you alive. And what he's saying is that these guys are just not going to wake up. They're just so slow and so, well, for lack of a better word, dumb, that they're just going to sit there and take it. You know, I'm going to just basically make a better product, and they're not going to copy me because they can't. And that's the audacity of Elon Musk, and I think the audacity of it all. And maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong. You know, there are some industries in the world that seem to be really, really thick-headed and unable to change. And,
it's also a saturated industry, right? I mean, in many cases, you've got the bean counters running the companies, and that might be
something to do, because one of the underlying axioms of disruption theory is that incumbents eventually get it and they respond. And if you threaten them enough, they will wake up and say, "This is a clear and present danger. This is an existential threat. I shall respond." What you hope for is that that's going to be too late. That you'll actually fly under the radar long enough that by the time you become a threat or a perceived and felt threat, then it's
the
too
game's
late
over
already.
Right.
Yeah, the
right.
game's over. So that's how Apple won. It was like, you know, it was like flying under the radar because it wasn't a really good phone, supposedly. But Elon Musk he's like waving the flag. Look at me. I'm better than you. I'm much better than you, in fact. And he's flaunting the fact that these guys are morons, and they still don't respond.
Part of it is his volume is tiny in the scheme of these big conglomerates, right? But
maybe we're just too much paying attention to the chattering classes that are covering the technology markets, but. But there is one explanation, by the way, and I think Clay is such a genius, because he's putting together a new paper. I was actually part of a roundtable last week where we discussed it, and he's published already an op-ed in the New York Times on this called "The Capitalist's Dilemma," and that work is work in progress about, you know, explaining why, in fact, some issues about the economy, the basic issues about how the economy is not responding properly by lowering the unemployment rate. So it's a completely he's going off in a direction that I would say most people would say, well, that's interesting, but how does it how is it relevant to me? But what I'm starting to think is actually that he's identified what he calls the financialization of the economy, meaning that the finance people are in charge at all levels, you know, not just of the, you know, corporate offices, but all the way in the government. And so the question now is all revolving around these guys who say, look, if these ratios, the financial ratios aren't right, then we got to change things. And they're forgetting that actually those ratios measure certain things that can be measured and are probably not the relevant things to be measured. Like, you know, you're not measuring where value actually exists. You're optimizing instead of creating. Anyway, long story, but what I would say is that if here, this would explain the falling asleep at the switch dilemma. If you're a large company and then you have a competitor who jumps up and down and saying, I'm better than you, I'm going to kill you, I've got the product for it, people love me, and all these other things, and you sit there, you know, as with the deer in the headlights, and you're like, I'm not going to do anything about this. Now, what normal people would see that, and their instinct would tell them, you know, you better do something about it, right? Wake up. But the fact is that if you're in a financialized state of mind, you don't care.
You're euthanized.
You're just looking at your numbers.
Yeah.
And you're like saying, well, I don't care what this lunatic says, right? I'm going to look at my ratios. Am I getting better return on invested assets? Am I getting a better IRR? If so, I don't care. I don't care. And you just keep going, following your spreadsheet, and then right off the cliff, because that guy eventually is going to kill you, as he promised he would.
Right. So, well, part of economic dynamism is churn, right? I mean, Jobs talked about that, you know, death being one of the greatest inventions.
But
if we don't have churn, how do you have innovation? How do you have...
But the point, the crucial thing about the theory in the disruption happens is that it's invisible. And the crucial thing that Clay and Jobs felt that the success metric was that, look, you gotta basically shut up. You know, don't tell the world how much you're going to succeed in the future, or do it in an asymmetric way and so that the big guy stays asleep.
Right. No, so the product takes care of that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, the financialization theory would suggest that actually it doesn't matter how much you tell the world you're going to be disruptive, unless they see it in numbers. So in other words, the financial guys hijacked common sense. They just went in and then flipped.
Quants took over.
Yeah, they flipped the brain off. They said, okay, yeah, you know, your instincts tell you that these guys might come and get you. You know, it's like a movie. You're watching a movie and yeah, you feel emotion, but ignore it. Ignore all of that. I've got the numbers in the spreadsheet to prove that it's not going to happen. So you fight what is really an instinctive response that people would normally respond to. But it's just that that's what might explain and the thing that Elon Musk is taking advantage of. And a lot of these companies in Silicon Valley are taking advantage of because they're by no means quiet, or, you know, in fact, that even to the point, let's forget about the PR of Musk, but let's just look at the fact that it is hugely visible as an investment. It's hugely visible in terms of the mainstream, what's happening there, the valuation, the record-breaking ratios, PE. And this is the same phenomenon with Google and with Amazon and partly with Apple, that these guys are essentially kings of the world, and they're going around disrupting industry after industry, and somehow the incumbents are not responding, even though by no means this is a secret. That's what I'm trying to point out, and I'm wondering, why are they so foolish as to not respond in kind? And again, the answer may be that they're just financialized. Financialized meaning, again, the brain is shut off.
So we've covered a lot of ground today, and I want to close just with the model I find somewhat interesting from a current player, especially since BMW has built this endless line expansion that's causing their dealers problems and all that. But they have this I-Series electric car that's coming out, and one of the things they're talking about is owners will have the ability to use, you know, an SUV or a different type of car if they need to make a long trip. And I think that move to more of a car as a service gives you a glimpse of, I think, where it's going to go. I'm not sure who will be the winner, who will step into that role, but it's interesting that while they have this whole financial-driven line extension or endless line extension going on, that they have a little project run differently, apparently, to think different, as it were. So we'll continue to have a lot to talk about, Horace.
Yeah, definitely need to talk about that. And yeah.
It's always always a pleasure.
I series, yeah. So good stuff. Let's make sure we do this soon.